Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the NYUKCHA Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest is Maiko Kyogoku, who is a second-generation Japanese-American and the owner of Besso, a unique and super charming Japanese restaurant in NoHo. Maiko was born and raised in New York and worked for the contemporary artist Takashi Murakami as project manager. So she was responsible for managing Murakami's collaborations with Kanye West and Louis Vuitton. So today we'll talk about Maiko's drastic career change, how she interprets Japanese cuisine as a second-generation American, Japanese regional cuisine, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes and Stitcher as podcasts. Please go to iTunes and Stitcher and subscribe to Japan Eats. Also, if you have ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org. And finally, many of you have asked where to dine in Japan, so I created a list of our recommendations on our website. Please go to Japan Eats show page on heritageradionetwork.org, and the link is at the end of the show description, or you can go to heritageradionetwork.org/where-to-dine-in-Japan. That is on heritageradionetwork.org/ and where-to-dine-in-Japan, all connected by hyphens. Now, let's start our conversation with Maiko Kyogoku. Hi, Maiko. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so you were born and raised in New York, quintessential New Yorker. And so where did you grow up in New York, and what did you eat when you grew up?
So I grew up on the Upper West Side in New York, and my parents owned a Japanese restaurant, and my mother was a wonderful cook. She made a lot of Japanese home cooking, different dishes all the time. So I was exposed to a lot of Japanese food at home, but also ate all different kinds of foods. Just being in New York, like everything from hot dogs to pizza to Indian food. So I grew up eating a whole variety of different cuisines. Mm,
that sounds very New York. Your father owned a sushi restaurant. And it was Rikyu. So did you think of opening your own restaurant when you grew up?
I think I was very, I wanted nothing to do with the restaurant business at first. I knew how hard it was. I never saw my father when I was going to sleep. He was still at work. And when I was, going to school, he was sleeping. And even he himself was always like, it's not an industry for girls. So, it's a lot of hours and it's a lot of manual labor. So initially I didn't want to be part of the restaurant world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you have a very unique career path. So as I said at the beginning of the show, you worked as project manager for the contemporary artist Takashi Murakami. at Kaikai Kiki, and you were responsible for managing his collaborations with Kanye West and Louis Vuitton. So what did you learn from the job?
You know, I learned about how hardworking Japanese people are. I mean, I consider myself a hard worker as well, but, you know, I felt like that job really tested my emotional, physical, and mental limits as a person. And the people I worked with were so inspiring. They were very, you know, dedicated and determined, and really kind of loyal to the company. And I learned about just kind of the grit that and determination that's needed in achieving something. It's really inspiring.
Interesting. So that reminds me of, you know, the famous lifetime employment. And still, I think people say lifetime employment is kind of disappearing. But I think by nature, people assume you keep working for the company unless you do something crazy bad, we decide to quit. So is that kind of a corporate culture that you had?
I don't know if, you know, I think that everyone who worked there was really passionate. And I think that, yeah, there was a little bit of that for sure. He has a studio in Japan as well as New York. And I was working out of the New York office, but traveled back and forth quite often. But there was definitely that kind of lifer mentality for some people. Mm. But just kind of this almost blind loyalty to the company was really, like, you know, really resonated with everybody. And I learned a lot about just kind of putting the group first or putting the company first. That was a big lesson I learned.
Right. So your colleagues are mostly Japanese people?
A lot of Japanese people, but in the New York office, a lot of the people who made the artwork were non-Japanese Americans. And that kind of work philosophy really was instilled in them as well. So, you know, I guess it's not just Japanese people, but that kind of work culture was a big part of that.
Interesting. Right. So it's a collaboration, that kind of the dedication collaboration.
Right.
Okay. So, and also I think there's an interview I read about that you said you shared your own love for Japanese culture with
That's true. Yes. So, you know, one of the things I was really kind of inspired by and admired about Mr. Murakami is that he really wanted to share his love of Japanese art and technique and culture through his works. Mm-hmm. And even in his work culture, I think that, you know, the mentality of being Japanese, or what he believed is Japanese, was an important aspect of creating Kaikai Kiki, his company. And it really influenced the way that I, you know, run my own business or think about, you know, how I would present myself as a Japanese person, or even just in opening Besso, you know, what kind of Japanese culture I want to share with others.
Right. Yeah, actually, I've been to one of his exhibitions, and he promotes other Japanese artists too. So it's kind of extended love for Japanese culture. Right. So, but what made you to change your career to open a Japanese restaurant?
Well, I think that, you know, after I had, I mean, even in college, I was always interested in cooking and food. You know, when I was 18, I lost my mother, and I think that cooking was a big part of remembering her, but also just, you know, not wanting to forget the dishes I grew up with. Mm. And so I cooked a lot in college, after college, and my first job was in publishing, but something really drew me to restaurants. I don't know if it was just having seen, you know, my dad, like, even though I didn't really help out at the restaurant that much when I was younger, I would always be there for street fairs. And, you know, there's an annual Columbus Street Festival. Mm. My sister and I would put our aprons on and help sell, like, their last rolls of sushi or something. Right. And, you know, I really loved the energy of a restaurant. And so in publishing, when I was, you know, on the weekends, I would stage at a restaurant in Midtown. It was a Japanese restaurant called Naniwa that's still there.
Right.
and I really fell in love. Like it, and then after I left Kaikai Kiki, I went to Momoya and worked there. And I had been a hostess for them in college, but I became a manager, and that was kind of the beginning of working in hospitality full time.
Okay, so not just because it's Japanese, it's more like a restaurant business culture that you liked.
Yeah, I think it was a combination of just loving the excitement and energy of a restaurant. And I always think that, you know, restaurants are such a magical place. It's like where, I mean, it's partly where I grew up because my family is a restaurant family, but it's where you create memories. It's where you share ideas, you know, spend time with loved ones. And I was always enamored with creating that space, right. You know, or just seeing that, like a restaurant come alive.
Right. It's almost like a theater. Like,
it is.
And you never know what happens and what kind of ingredients, what kind of requests you get, and what kind of problems you have.
At Barbalud, when I was working for Danielle, like one of my bosses was always like, get ready, it's showtime. It's like, you know, it is like the start of a theater.
Right. So. I just got a book. That's really great. Okay. I heard that you helped Ivan Okin to open his first ramen shop in New York, who actually came to our show on episode 16. So what kind of job did you have then, and what did you learn from the job?
So I guess after my time at Kaikai Kiki and also working at different restaurants, I did start having this feeling like I want to open my own business. You know, growing up in a restaurant family, my parents were big supporters of like the entrepreneurial spirit and just following your dreams and being passionate about that. So I started feeling like, you know, how do I get there to open a business? Like, what steps should I take? And I felt like I was lacking the business experience, and the knowledge of opening a restaurant. Like, what does it take to really open a business in New York? So I was working at Thompson Hotels for a couple of years, but then I moved to Tungsten, which is a multidisciplinary company. They have different facets, but they were trying to develop a restaurant sector where they were helping chefs and restaurateurs find spaces, develop business plans. And so I was, you know, I became someone who would help chefs find spaces. I got my broker's license, and that's how I met Ivan. I helped him find his space on Clinton Street.
Right. So your title was Director of Business Development,
yes.
Food and Beverage.
Yes.
So it summarizes everything. Right. So you must have really had a great experience to learn, as if you opened your own place.
I met so many people and, you know, was able to see the process of opening a restaurant kind of before anything happens, you know. So everything from forecasting kind of financial projections to what licenses are needed to open a space, what permits are needed. These were things that were completely unknown to me, not to mention, you know, negotiating leases. I mean, that's a huge part of owning a business. So I was, you know, directly involved in that, and it really helped to make the next step for me later.
Amazing. And as you practice, it's kind of going to school, being paid also.
You could say that. I definitely felt like I learned from seeing other people's experiences.
Right, because I think the first of financials and licensing, everything, that's the most part people got exhausted even before opening the restaurant. So,
right.
Great. But I just, you know, you're talking about the entrepreneurial spirits, and I want to ask you a little bit more about your dad. Your father is really kind of interesting person, right? Can you tell us about that?
He's definitely a character. He's So he owned a restaurant for 30 years on the Upper West Side. You know, he'll always be the first person to tell you about his story.
Mm, okay. I wish he was here too.
But he's like a self-proclaimed, self-made man, and he really was tired of the way that Japan was when he was growing up in the 60s and 70s. So after college, he moved to Spain.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a time that, you know, after World War II, everybody was working hard to recover from the whole damages and growing fast.
But there was and he was part of the baby boomer generation where it's very hard to get noticed. There's so many of them, you know. So he definitely felt like his opportunities lied outside of Japan. And so he, you know, through opportunities helped someone open a restaurant in Madrid. It was like the first Japanese restaurant. And then it was just one night a customer told him to go and go to New York if he really wanted an opportunity. That's where, you know, dreams come true. And he didn't have any money. He just flew to New York and then didn't even have a place to stay, but that customer told him to go find a certain restaurant where they were, you know, he knew of the owner. And so my dad asked for a job, and then they didn't have an opening, so they told him to go across the street. And that's how he got his first job in New York.
Oh, wow.
But then it was like years, you know, a few years later, he married my mother. He had saved up enough money to maybe take out a loan and to open a place. And then, you know, the rest was history. So he has stayed in New York ever since. Wow. And now he's retired.
But this classic, beautiful American.
Right. It's like the immigrant American dream story.
Right. Right. Okay. And so you opened the business in August 2016. Mm-hmm. So, well, let me ask you, what was the toughest challenge in opening Beso?
You know, even though I had experience seeing other people kind of struggle through the pre-construction processes, I could not have foreseen how challenging that actually is.
Mm.
You know, I took over the space that used to be Bianca Restaurant on Bleecker Street, and that restaurant had been in operation for 12 years, and then there was a restaurant before that was there for 12 years, so it was like undoing 24 years of, you know, different messes, like, internally. So we had to basically gut the whole place, even though it was an old restaurant, and just start fresh.
But so you didn't expect that.
I didn't expect at all. So that was probably the biggest challenge. And then, you know, it's notorious in New York, but you wait for gas forever. You know, that's like sometimes you're ready to go, but there's no gas in the building for
you. Medicine.
We had to wait for a little while for that. So, yeah.
Okay. And what about finding a chef? Because I sometimes get asked, do you know a chef, Japanese chef?
Right.
And there's so many problems to find a good chef in New York.
So I was lucky to have met Emily Yuan, who is our executive chef, you know, when we worked together for Danielle Balloon. And she was a sous chef there. She was the executive sous chef at DBGB in Singapore before that. And I always wanted to work with a female chef. I felt like for the concept of Beso, for the kind of person I am, and also the kind of culture I wanted to create, I thought that it was important to team up and have, you know, like an all-women team in terms of, you know, my partner. So, and she and I get along so well. We bounce ideas off of each other all the time, and it's really, you know, it's a working partnership that's also a friendship, and it's really wonderful.
Hey, congratulations. Yeah, because, like, notoriously Japanese chef culture is so male dominant and very harsh way sometimes.
I also think that for the type of restaurant I wanted to do, I think that, you know, a lot of Japanese chefs are very traditional and very kind of set in terms of how they want to create Japanese food. And, you know, the entire concept of Beso is very different from that. It's, kind of finding new ways of interpreting Japanese cuisine. So I needed someone who had, you know, in some ways, I was looking for someone with no background in Japanese cuisine so they can have a fresh perspective on
it. So white canvas. So by the way, what's the beso? What does it mean, beso?
Beso means vacation home or getaway home. Means like a little retreat, basically, in Japanese. So that's a big part of, you know, that I wanted that feeling of people to escape from their everyday. You know, I think that that's like the beauty of a restaurant in itself. But yeah, I wanted to create a little safe haven from the everyday at Beso.
So it's still your house, but you don't spend all the time there. You're familiar, comfortable, but that's your getaway. And so what's the concept of Beso?
Beso is, you know, what we try to do at Beso is serve Japanese home cooking with creative twists. And I think that you see a lot of authentic flavors of Japanese cuisine, but then different interpretations of it through maybe different spices or different cultures. And, you know, we don't feel like very tied down to specific ways of doing something. I guess for me, you know, I wanted to create Beso to initially really just to share my family's home recipes with other people. I think that, you know, in a city full of Japanese restaurants, you never really see Japanese home cooking. You see a lot of sushi and ramen, but not really comfort food.
That's true.
And I really wanted to share that because, you know, for myself, I never lived in Japan. I'm really a true New Yorker in that sense. But I identify as Japanese as well as American. And I, you know, the only way I knew being Japanese is through food. And so I really wanted to share that with others as well. But I also wanted to make it approachable for people so that they didn't feel like it was so foreign to them, you know. Our approach was to find kind of homey dishes that couldn't be nostalgic for Japanese people, but maybe evoke some kind of memory for non-Japanese people as well.
Interesting. And I think as far as I heard from you now, there is definitely a New York mindset. It's free to incorporate something interesting.
Yeah,
into
I think
tradition.
That like, that's the beauty of food. Like, food evolves all the time, you know? I mean, if you look at, like, ramen, it's now a Japanese food, but it used to be Chinese.
Right, yeah.
You know, or anything else. Like, a hot dog used to be German or, you know.
And hamburger.
hamburger. Like, pizza was Italian at one point, and now it's, you know, very American.
Right, and Chicago pizza. They don't have that.
Exactly. So I think Japanese food, you know, should be allowed to evolve, too. So that's kind of the idea behind what we're creating at Beso.
Right. So maybe you can give us some examples of those,
those dishes.
Unique, yeah.
Yeah, so, for example, we have a short rib kakuni. So, you know, beef kakuni is something, you know, a lot of times it's made with pork belly, but you can make with other meat. And for at least for me, like, it's such a comfort dish, you know. It's like my mother used to make that. My grandmother used to make kakuni.
And it's like a braised and soy,
right.
Mirin. And it's sake, and it's like really slowly braised, melting.
So it's like a braised dish, but, you know, we update that by using a bone-in short rib. And I think for a lot of people, maybe it reminds them of a pot roast or of like, yeah, like a big Sunday dinner or something. But maybe it also evokes like a time that they don't even know about, but it's just some kind of nostalgic feeling of a time they want, you know? I mean, that's like a little too philosophical.
But it's okay, because I think food is really pretty philosophical, mm-hmm. and you have to be like that.
Right, right. So, that's just one example. But, you know, we also have like a grilled romaine salad that uses goma dressing. So it's like a creamy sesame dressing that we make in-house. Mm. And I don't know, like growing up, that was like the dressing we would put on everything. Mm. We loved it. But we've updated it by using romaine that we just cut in half, we grill. And a lot of people are reminded of a Caesar salad.
Right.
But then goma dressing is very Japanese. So, mm. you know, it's like that combination of different right. memories.
It makes sense because like the roasted, the grilled romaine has this toastiness to go well with the sesame. So I think a culinary term, it's really making sense to... Mm-hmm. to put them together. Right. Okay, so let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about how Maiko maintains the traditional aspect of Japanese cuisine on her menu. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Maiko Kyogoku, who is a second-generation Japanese-American and the owner of Besso, a unique and very charming Japanese restaurant in Noho. So you have creative aspects on the menu at Besso, but what is authentic about the menu?
A lot of our base sauces and flavors are based on very traditional pantry items in Japanese homes. We use a lot of the sauces that we use are made by my father. He actually comes to the restaurant and prepares some of these sauces on a weekly basis. So, mm. you know, for example, we have this tama miso, which is an egg yolk based miso that you have to warm and kind of constantly stir. And you stir in the sugar and the meating and the egg yolks till it's incorporated and creamy.
Mm. I don't think it's common to see it even in Japan. It's such a very special item.
It's so funny because growing up, that's what was in our refrigerator. So I never thought that was not abnormal or unusual. Wow. I just thought that's like the miso.
Yeah, how lucky you are. So okay, and I remember when I had a dinner at Besso and the miso soup. And I smell, oh, wow, this is like my grandmother's place. Smell, it's so dashy, it's so authentic.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing because a lot of the, like, our kitchen team had no background in Japanese cuisine. Mm. But they have a strong appreciation for it. And they, work really hard to try to understand the the origins of things, like, you know, how you're, what's the proper way of making something. Mm. And then from there we, you know, maybe make some updates or changes. But the base is always very authentically Japanese, I think. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think I respect those people outside certain culture that objective approach actually tend to improve the original version quite a bit.
Right. Well, and they're looking at it from fresh eyes, fresh perspective. So mm-hmm. it's great to see, you know, we have our team is the same from when we opened, which wow. is also amazing. But, you know, Emily and we have Evan and Veronica, the three of them, they're like, you know, and we have a new member, Chris, actually, Chris mm. too. But yeah, they're amazing in trying to learn all the time. Mm. And then offering some ideas that maybe a Japanese chef wouldn't think of, because mm. it's, you know, to them, they have that flexibility because they're not tied down to tradition.
Right. Mm. So typically people say California rolls, but to me, avocado in sushi, like, you eat it, it makes sense.
Right. Like, yeah. And now that's like, that's Japanese food mm. in America. So, yeah.
Okay. And one thing I noticed about the menu is that you feature food from Akita Prefecture. And Akita is really a northern part of Japan. So why is that?
My mother's side of the family is from Akita, and although I never lived in Japan, I would travel there every few years. And some of the food there left such a lasting impression on me. It was a big part of me learning about Japanese cuisine, too. Mm. And when we got home, I mean, my mother would try to teach us these regional foods all the time, because she thought it was, you know, to her, and, you know, now I have the same feelings, but food is a big part of learning about another person, another person's culture. So, mm. you know, in order for us to, for my sister and I to kind of honor our heritage, she would try to have us try different foods all the time. Mm. So when we went back to her parents' house, we would always have these lavish meals.
Yeah. So they're waiting for you guys to come, and then this is, you have right. to remember this tradition.
So it's like all of the regional dishes laid out on the table.
Wow.
So,
yeah. Wow. That's great. Because my mother is from Tokyo, and, you know, my father is from the South, but I never had that kind of a strong regional mm-hmm. mindset.
So. Well, and also for me, because I was coming from New York, like that was kind of as country as I would ever get, you know. There was like nothing around. I mean, we were eating the vegetables from my grandmother's garden, just rice patties for miles and miles.
Wow.
So, you know, it was really special, and I loved it so much that, you know, kind of when we got home, like we Akita has this very famous hot pot nabe called kiritampo nabe. Mm-hmm. So we would bring some home and then, like, try to recreate that at home.
Mm. So kiritampo is basically, maybe you could just explain, because it's such a unique dish. What is kiritampo?
Kiritampo is basically a rice, a type of rice dumpling that's in a tube form. It has a hole in the middle.
Mm.
And kiritampo nabe is a hot pot that uses this rice dumpling, and then you add chicken, and it's like a chicken and rice dumpling stew.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, isn't the kiritampo, basically the rice is used to be originally, you know, it was stuck to the wood sticks, mm-hmm. and then you cooked.
Yes.
Right, around the fire.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if there was like a reason that they did this. Maybe it was just like the leftover rice or something.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I know that, you know, Akita is very cold. So mm. kiritampo is usually frozen, or it's kind of like you have to dry it, mm. you know, by grilling it. And right. it keeps for a very long time.
Mm.
So that must be one of the reasons.
Right, it's kind of the use of the emergency food as
right,
well.
Right, right. So, yeah. At home, like, because we don't have a hearth, mm-hmm. you know. We would make a more casual version called damako nabe, which mm-hmm. is basically rice balls. So, and then you grill it in the oven.
Mm.
So it'll be like similar taste,
right.
But the rice dumplings were in different shapes.
Mm. Okay. And what else like a typical other Akita's regional cuisine? Maybe you can give some other examples.
I mean, there were a lot of like ingredients that I had never seen before, like junsai, which is like a forest green, I guess. Is that what it is? It's from the pond.
Yeah, it's really hard to explain, but it's this kind of a jelly coated plant.
Yeah, I don't even know where it comes from, but because it was always in a jar.
Yeah, it comes from actually it's like I think Brasenia. Mm. It's like a floats in a clean lake or pond, and then there's a specific boat. You hand pick.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's like it's kind of pretty jelly and interesting texture.
I mean, it blew my mind when I would eat that. Like my grandmother would serve that with a little bit of grated radish and soy sauce, and you put that on rice, and it was so good. But you'll never find that here.
Yeah, I think it's only specialized in Akita. Like 90% comes from the junsai comes from Akita.
So I had that, and they have something called iburigakko, which is like smoked takuan, which is pickled daikon. So these are also things that I would love to incorporate at Besso.
Actually, I looked up why it's iburigakko, it's smoked, and then said, because it's so snowy and it's not sunny enough, you can't dry all those pickled items.
Oh,
doesn't get dried because it's moldy, right? So they had to smoke and then, just the salt.
Okay.
And
well, it's delicious.
Right. So it's just another step that to make it tastier.
Right.
And you have udon, right? Inaniwa udon.
We do, yeah. Oh, yeah. So Inaniwa udon is regional to Akita, and it's like a silkier, thinner udon than like sanuki or, other types. But that is a food that is very symbolic of Akita. And we actually have that on our menu.
Right. I think people say that's one of the three most famous udon dishes. Mm-hmm. They compete between regions, right? Sanuki is number one, Naniwa is number one. Yeah. So that's really a must dish that you have to eat at Besso.
I would say Inaniwa is number one.
Yeah, I have to kind of agree. But, it's competitive. So when you left Kaikai Kiki in 2009, you didn't have any previous food service experience. But, at this point, you've been open the restaurant for 7 months.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you want to achieve in the first place? It's like, of course, you serve a nice Japanese food in a very relaxing place. But
I wanted to open a restaurant and open Besso because I think it's important to share Japanese culture with others. I mean, for me, growing up bicultural Japanese American, I've always felt like an ambassador to Japanese culture, to my friends, to those who don't know Japanese culture. I grew up always being one of the only Japanese people in my whole school.
Upper West Side.
Right, exactly.
Right.
So, I was always the person with the answer, even though I had never lived there before.
You can make up answers.
Right. So, but then you kind of become that because you are always that person, And I think, my parents really instilled their love and pride of Japanese culture in me, and I really want to share that kind of the potential of Japanese food with others. I think there's so many different types of Japanese dishes that are still unknown in America, and this is only a small part of it, but I wanted to share some of the comfort foods and home cooking.
So is your plan, you're going to start introducing some other different kind of regional cuisine?
Well, I think Yeah, I think in the future I would love to. I mean, right now we are incorporating more dishes. We're working on a kamol nambang soba. We're actually working on kind of being inspired by junsai, doing vegetables in a gelée,
right.
And adding that to a vegetarian soba dish. So it's like things like that we're just playing around. But I think the inspiration comes from these Japanese dishes you won't find here.
Right. Yeah. First time I saw the menu at the Beso, it's just really, I was so pleased to see regional cuisine, which I don't think understood very well yet in this country, because izakaya is a category, ramen is a category. And right. Sushi, of course, is a category. But there's so many different variations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I don't want to claim to be an expert, but I think that the way that I learned about Japanese culture was through food. And so if I can share just even a little bit of that with other people, I think that, I hope I'm able to do that.
Right. Okay, and by the way, who comes to Beso? What are your customer demographics?
There's a good mix of different types of people. We have, people from the fashion world, people from the art world.
That's from your background, I guess.
I think so. I mean, I think my background and... I think people see the restaurant and they feel like it's somewhat different. We're in NoHo and it's very congested in other parts, but our street is kind of sleepy and it's a little bit like a secret spot.
Right, and just like one step into this street, right?
Right. So I think when people find us, they feel like they've discovered something. Mm.
Looking Bowery, what is this place?
So, yeah, I think that that's, that helps and attract a certain type of person, too.
Mm, okay. Yeah. And what's the percentage of Japanese people? Do you see Japanese people, too?
Yeah, I think, it depends. A third of people are Japanese, I think, and they range. I mean, there's definitely a lot of East Asian customers as well.
Right.
I think, but Japanese customers are always very impressed by how authentic it tastes, but then maybe the presentation is completely different from what they would expect.
I had the same impression. Yeah, it was such a great surprise. Right, and but you've been running Beso successfully for 7 months, and what are you learning and discovering from the experience of running a restaurant?
I am learning, I really have so much respect for all those people who work every day for so many years. I mean, I have a newfound respect for my father more than ever after, doing this for 30 years. That's crazy.
How did he do that?
I'm not sure. But it's a very hard lifestyle. Mm. And to do it every day, I have so much appreciation for my staff, my chef, who's the smiliest chef you'll ever meet. It's very difficult to be continue to be so upbeat, and she provides a really positive environment. So, but I'm learning just how to be grounded every day, and this routine is challenging sometimes. I've always done this. I've been in hospitality for 10 years now, but it's different when you own a business.
Right.
It's a lot more at stake, a lot more responsibilities.
But your eyes are sparkling and sounds like you found the right place to be.
Thank you.
Right. And I heard you had some collaboration with people such as Micheline Thomas, who was a very famous artist.
Yes, so just recently Micheline did a collaborative dinner with us where we took some of her home cooking kind of dishes she prepares at home.
But she has nothing to do with Japanese cuisine. That's no. necessary, right?
Right. She's not even, I mean, she's not a professional chef or anything, mm-hmm. but she does love, you know, food and cooking and entertaining. Mm-hmm. And she does love Japanese food. And I want to do these types of dinners where different worlds come together mm. and you create something new. Aye. That was, it was so wonderful to see how her ideas and our dishes kind of came together and we created this whole different dish.
Like what kind of?
We did like lamb tsukune meatballs on bamboo skewers that had crushed pistachio wow. nuts and some wild cherries. That oh was God. Like inspired by a lamb meatball dish she often makes at home.
Mm, and pistachio and lamb.
Yeah. Right. And then we did a duck curry nambang that is now kind of, you know, we've taken that dish and we're developing it some more to incorporate it into wow. our spring menu. But she has, her family is of Caribbean heritage, so there was like some incorporation of Caribbean spices, and that's where the curry came from.
Right. So, yeah. Interesting. So it sounds like Beso is a place to bridge the two Japanese and other cultures.
I hope that it becomes like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. That's wonderful. So congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. So, thank you for joining us today. And, listeners, if you'd like to know more about Michael's restaurant, please go to Beso, NYC, beso.nyc, that is BESSOU.NYC. Okay. And if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher podcast. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And today's show was made possible by Corinne, and our engineer is David Tatasiore. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube.
Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.